Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Roger North, and this is True North. And today's episode is going to be talking about kind of classical conspiracy material, and that's looking at the deaths of various people, their assassinations, and what really went on behind the scenes. So what we have on today's show, I'm interviewing Ole Damegaard. I'm sorry, I'm having trouble with it. I apologize.
Damegaard.
Okay. Damegaard. Is that correct, sir?
No, it sounded great. Damegaard.
Damegaard. Anyways, so Ole is going to be talking about basically common thread that runs through a number of very high-profile deaths and other crimes that have happened, terrorist events, and what connects them. And we're going to discuss in detail how these seemingly disparate events, for example, the deaths of JFK and his brother RFK and Martin Luther King Jr., are connected. We're also going to look at other people's deaths, including people, for example, like Whitney Houston, apparently died of natural causes. And we're going to be seeing common threats. So with that, I want to bring Ole into the show, and welcome to the show. Welcome, Ole. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much, Roger, for having me on.
Well, it's my pleasure. I've been looking for this. Very excited. This is a subject I really wanted to explore, and you know, I have heard there are connections between some of these deaths, and I wanted you to kind of explain how did you get into doing this kind of work. Your website it's Light on Conspiracies, isn't it?
LightOnConspiracies.com. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I know you have a newsletter.
And my book in this subject is called Coup d'État in Slow Motion.
Coup d'État. Well, it's often been used to describe exactly what happened. Yes, in slow motion. And that's, I think, probably a very good description of what happened with the death of JFK, which we'll get into in just a moment. Can you tell us how you got into studying this, sir?
Yeah, I've been down this road for about 30 years now, and I used to work as a journalist. I was born in Denmark in a family that was very much involved in the Nazi, resistance movement against the Nazi occupation during the Second World War. And I was brought up with all these stories about how important it is to really look into what's going on and to dare to stand up against things that is not right. And when people are being bullied around and killed, and so how important it is to be courageous and brave, even though it can be very, very scary. Then when I was a child, we moved to Sweden, and I grew up there, started working as a journalist. And in the early 1980s, I became very, very interested, I would say almost obsessed with the JFK assassination. And because once I started looking into this case, it was so obvious from day one that something very strange was going on, that the official story did not make any sense whatsoever. And this took me down this road where I think I read a couple of hundred books at least. I did, because this is such a multi-layered conspiracy, the JFK assassination, extremely complicated. And while I was doing that, I became more and more interested in the Robert Kennedy assassination, Martin Luther King, Abraham Lincoln, Malcolm X, and so on. And it came to a point after a few years, I was starting to write my own book about the JFK assassination, not to get it published, just to try and figure out this whole big jigsaw puzzle, because it is so complex and multilayered and very confusing, because for instance, one person in one book that sounded very trustworthy, one person, for instance, could be very much involved with the Chicago mob. And then in another book that sounded just as trustworthy, he was working for the CIA. Yet another book, he was financed by the FBI. And in yet another book, he was part-time working for the Secret Service. And I was like, this is so weird. I mean, something of this cannot be correct. I mean, it has to be either the one or the other. Turned out I was totally wrong, because it actually was the truth that quite a few of these people are very much involved in the CIA and their covert operations, as well as in bed with the mob and financed by the FBI and so on. So it's a very confusing world to get into, because these organizations like the CIA, FBI and so on, that I grew up thinking that they were there to protect us, are actually deeply involved in many, many, many of these awful atrocities that are committed against the normal population. And after a while studying all of these assassinations, it was almost like I could start almost seeing like a bullet point list that was being used like a template on how to carry out assassinations like this. Not the exact way that the shooting was done and so on, but the whole setup with how it was all blamed on a lone crazy patsy, how the whole trial was rigged, how the investigation was rigged from people that seemed very much connected to the crime itself, and then how the whole thing was set as a massive cover-up, followed by, if people didn't buy the official story, then in the end they would appoint a so-called committee like the Warren Commission or something like that, and that would also be part of the crime itself. And it was just mind-blowing the more I got into it. And I actually managed to track this way back to the Roman age, you know, the old Roman times, where many of the tactics that are being used and templates and methods that are being used today are old Roman tactics that was created then, and now we're just experiencing like a high-tech modern version of them, but they're exactly the same. And they're all set how to commit crimes and atrocities to dupe the population into thinking that it was the deed of a lone crazy individual. And then they come with a solution, which is a very hidden agenda, but all the time aimed at more and more control of the population, to get the population to freely give up their liberties by having the living daylight scared out of them. That will make them welcome whatever strong methods I will offer them for their protection, as it's called. Then in 1986, the Swedish Prime Minister was, his name was Olof Palme, and he was shot down in the streets of Stockholm by, once again, a lone crazy guy. And at that point, I thought, sorry?
I remember that one, yes.
Yeah. At that point, I thought that I was living in a country without corruption, in a country where I could trust the police, we were being pumped with this being the perfect country, the ones that helped the poor and weak, and where democracy was perfect and so on. So I thought for sure, I mean, a trauma, it was an extreme national trauma, just like the JFK assassination was for the states. This was the same for Sweden, because Sweden had never experienced any violent crime of that magnitude ever. And so I thought for sure the police are going to do a great job, and within a few months they're going to catch this guy and solve it. And but I was in for quite a big surprise, I must say, because it didn't take long before I started seeing the exact same signs as from the other assassinations. It was following the same kind of bullet point list that the other ones were following. So that really sort of, I couldn't understand it. How is it possible that an assassination in Sweden can follow the exact same template as several ones in the States or in Chile or in South Africa? And how is it possible if they're not connected somehow?
Interesting.
So what I did was I quit my job. I said bye-bye to my family, everything. I moved to Stockholm to be as close as possible to this crime, to see if I could find out what was going on. And so I gave up everything. I moved there. I started working. You know, I was still doing everything from driving a bus to cleaning toilets to working in warehouses and so on, just to get an income to get me going while I was trying to track down the real truth behind this assassination. And, well, it's taken me down a very, very long, very dark, violent route that is unfortunately the way most sincere truth seekers have been having to face, at least for many years, especially before the internet became so active and big. Because once you start digging into the real truth behind these events, you are in for a major surprise, because these are hard-hitting forces that are behind it. They deal with problems in a very violent way, and unfortunately many, many people have been taken out over the years. Two of my friends was murdered in strange ways, and I was threatened as well. So after 12 years of doing my utmost to find the truth in Sweden, I decided to leave my home country, because it was just getting too close, and I had no desire to become part of statistics. So this is why I'm now in Spain since 14 years.
I see. Okay, a couple of points. One thing I'm sure you learned later on is it's not unusual. For example, if you look at like the Major League insiders, that they'll often be, for example, they might be a 33rd degree Mason, they might be a Knights Templar, they might be a Bilderberger, they might be the Trilateral Commission, they might be, you know, multiple things like that. It's kind of the same basic idea where, like you're talking about these people, they're part of the Chicago mob, they're CIA, they're FBI, where it's exactly, I guess, analogous to where you have these people where they're in all these different secret societies that are all interlocking and interconnected to each other. So I suppose that's a big point that I wanted to make. So in some ways, I suppose in retrospect, it's really not that surprising because it's totally analogous to that. Can you go into a little more detail about this template? I mean, you discussed a couple general points, but I've got a feeling it's much more detailed than what you mentioned before.
It is much more detailed. I really want to point out, and I totally agree with you, with these hidden networks that are, when I started, I had absolutely no idea about these Freemasonry networks, secret groups like the Bilderberg Group, the Trilateral Commission, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Committee of 300, Skull and Bones. I had no idea. I looked upon these crimes as separate entities almost, you know, that had nothing to do with each other. But over the years, what I've found, whatever I've looked into, more or less every single one that I looked into, and I've done a lot of research over the year, the trails have just been pointing down those same track and led to the same group of what they call themselves the global elite, but a small group of powerful people in the world that have been carrying out a very, very dark and sinister hidden agenda for decades without most of us even having any idea what's going on. So I think it's extremely important to expose these secret networks and who are involved and how they're connected and so on, because only then can you start seeing what's going on, because many, many of these people are connected behind the scene. Their loyalties, even though they look on TV really nice and honest and decent, behind the scenes their loyalties are very much often connected to these hidden networks. And the Bilderberg Group is one group that I specialized on for years, and I was also invited as a key speaker to the Bilderberg, not the meeting itself, but the protest meeting right outside the hotel just a month ago and so ago. I can go into that afterwards, because I humbly think that I might have defused a possible false flag massacre there.
Really?
But, yeah. I can go into detail later on. I tell you,
sure.
My God, if what I think was planned there, oh, awful, awful. But you were talking about the template, the old Roman templates. Do you want one for assassinations or templates, or do you want them both? And I can just begin.
Why don't you do both of them? Start with the assassination, and maybe if you could relate it to, say, the JFK, because that's the best known of the assassinations, and that's obviously clearly was an assassination, but, you know, just so people can kind of see how it operates it in action, so they can have an example. It's kind of like, you know, you teach by maybe showing an example of something.
I tell you, it's. I prefer many times going into just showing the templates, first of all, because
sure.
once you start seeing it, once normal people start observing how this is carried out, it's so easy to see spot the next time there's a so-called mass shooting or terrorist mm-hmm. attack or something like that. You will spot the signs right away and just like, whoa, wait a second. I'm not going to buy into this right away. I'm going to check it out for myself. And very soon you will see that many, many, many of these are false flag operations set there to dupe the population into accepting their agenda. But
okay.
let's start with an assassination.
Okay. That's
the
good.
Way it was, I'll describe it the way it was done before today, that the surveillance is so high-tech nowadays, so it works on a different level. But the way it used to and the way it still is carried out to a certain extent when it comes to surveillance, this is how they do it. Okay, the victim is most of the time either a direct enemy to their agenda. Very often this person, when you're against their agenda is death and destruction, war, awful, awful for the rest of humanity. And the people that they target are often people who stand for the beautiful ethics in life, like peace, unity, nonviolence, brotherhood, all of these things that most normal people would like. But they become sometimes a major problem for this elite. Anyway, it can also be someone of their own, in their own ranks, somebody who they see as a possible threat, as a whistleblower, or somebody they just want to get rid of. Maybe he's become too big-headed, or it's whatever, they want to get rid of him. So what is done is that first a team is flown in or transported into the country. These the team that carry these operations out are normally working globally, so they just fly from country to country to country. And normally a team of about 9 people is sent in for surveillance. You have often like three teams of 3. They're connected with radio and so on. And what they do is they start for maybe 3-4 weeks before the assassination itself to keep the victim to become the target under surveillance, to check out his habits, his routes, where he goes, where he works, where he lives, how he goes to and from work, everything to start making sort of like a plan for how this could be carried out. So these 3 teams, they work 24/7, and the reason why they're 3 is they go 3 shift, so they work 8 hours each. And So these people will often be observed close to where the victim lives, close to where he works, and so on. Witnesses will have seen odd people and so on hanging around for days and so on. But these witnesses will, once after the hit is done, they will always be neglected or harassed or whatever. But that's standard. Okay, mm-hmm. So you have the surveillance team in. At the same time, these people also often check out the area. If it's done in a city, for instance, then they will put great effort into checking out possible escape routes, the best place, the best location for the hit itself, with multiple escape cars, multiple escape routes, also checking out, so there's no risk of traffic jams or train crossings or one-way streets, because the escape needs to be clean. So this is things that they also put effort into checking out. Okay, so while the surveillance is being done, a patsy is being prepared. This is often a totally innocent guy. He can be mind-controlled sometimes through the MKUltra system, because they don't trust mind-controlled people to do the hit itself. At least that's not my experience, but sometimes they're good to take the fall for it, because you can control that person, and then once he goes down, you can just stuff him away somewhere or kill him, and that's case closed. Anyway, the patsy is being prepared. This can also be somebody they have big problems with anyway. If it's a group, then it would be, at the moment, the trend is against the truth movement or veterans or homeless people. These are the groups they want to get rid of. So preparations are made to produce fake evidence that will, as soon as the shots are fired, there would be a technical team that goes in, clear the crime scene, and plant the fake evidence that would point straight to this patsy, whoever is aimed to take the fall.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time as the patsy is being prepared, this is often somebody who he needs to look good in media. He needs to look convincing for the main population. So in the 60s, this patsy was often like Russians or East Germans, because then the fear was from the East. Then when the Cold War ended, they changed the trend of the patsy to the Muslims, because the Muslims were absolute great for taking the fall for this, because they look great in media. They're dark eyes, big eyebrows, maybe a mustache. They have weird names like Abdul Karim Hussein, Abdul Khala, something like that. And they come from countries where most people have no idea where it even is. You know, so if the media constantly pumps out that this Abdul Karim did this terror attack, people will say, okay, fine, I truly believe it. They won't even hesitate to believe it. So for a long time, the Muslims were the patsies, the type. Then after 9/11, that went sort of out of trend, because they had just overdone it. So now the trend has gone more to Scandinavian-looking people, blonde, blue-eyed, maybe computer geeks, something like that, so that people will start fearing just anyone. It can just be anyone, you know, the terrorist. It can be your neighbor. It could be my son. It can be just anyone. Anyway, but the main thing is that this guy looks good in media. Maybe if you go for the lone crazy guy, then maybe it's a mentally weak person. It's good if he looks like weird on photos in media, or he's got a background maybe with some violence or some mm-hmm. that he says crazy things or something like that. That's perfect. So this is the type of guy you would target. Okay, so while the evidence and the patsy is being prepared, I also put my own investigation on standby. I'm the one behind this crime, okay? Mm-hmm. So the investigation would consist only of people that I control, and this I will control them through networks like Freemasonry networks, or like most of the time that is the way, or people that are just loyal to the cause. So mm-hmm. I have my own crime investigation on standby, and their task is, as soon as the shots are fired, they would just move in and just knock out all normal, decent kind of detectives, homicide investigators, police officers. They will just be pushed aside, and my investigation will go straight in, take over everything, and the only task they have is to cover the whole thing up, cover it up, and deal with media pointing out, well, they went that way, they went that way, they went that way, and all the time blame the patsy. It was the patsy, it was the patsy, it was
the
patsy.
And the patsy has never actually did it.
No, never. He's totally innocent.
Okay.
The patsy is always innocent.
Okay.
He has nothing to do with it. He's just taking the fall for it.
Mm-hmm.
And then also what the investigation will do is they will, if somebody like myself is very persistent in trying to find out the truth and is starting to become a problem after a while, they have access to so-called cleanup teams. Very, very violent people with a military background or from security forces or something like that, that will deal with truth seekers, you know, either beat them up, scare them, discredit them, or kill them, suicide them. You know, there's so many that have committed suicide by drowning themselves in the bathtub fully dressed while stabbing themselves from behind, or some, you know, these type of assassinations or suicides. So I've got my own investigation. I got the surveillance team. They've found out the good place to do the hit. Everything is set up. Everything is prepared. The patsy is prepared. The evidence is prepared. My investigation is on standby. Okay, so now is the time that I fly in the actual assassins. Now, the assassins that are used more or less always are very, very professionals. We're talking professional assassins, mercenaries, skilled killers. And these people are often taken from the CIA, the mob, if you're in the States, or from networks, secret networks like the Gladio network in Europe, or the, all the NATO countries had this. It's like a shadow guerrilla movement of very, very violent people. So the assassins are taken from there, and they are then flown in or transported into the countries from different directions so that they don't come as a whole group. These people are working on the code name, so even the people in the same hit team have no idea who their real identity is. And the whole operation is done on a need-to-know basis, totally compartmentalized. That is standard procedure, so that no one can step forward and become a whistleblower or tell the truth about the whole thing. They will only know their little task, their duty, and nothing else. And so I think we're getting there, and the time of the hit, sometimes the power behind these assassinations are very much into numerology or the exact position of where they want the hit to be carried out. This is also connected to Freemasonry and different rituals and so on. I'm not an expert in that. I can just say it repeats itself. I've seen it many, many times. And some of the signs on the side of the assassination are obelisk or the eternal flame or things like that. If this symbol is not there before, then within a year after the assassination, an obelisk will be erected in the vicinity of the crime scene, like 100 meters down the road for the decoration of the park or something like that. But it's almost like they're very proud and put like a business card there for people in their own people from their own family that they can recognize what's going has happened. Okay, so the time for the hit has come, and what happens then is I've also got a local backup. This is normally right-wing sources within the local police force. This is Nazi element in the local police force, former security people, former mercenaries and so on. And what they do is they help the team of assassins with all types of logistics, like food, housing, weapons, ammo, maps, additional info on the victim, all of these types. And they keep moving them around in small groups. They're never all of them together at the same time, in small groups between different safe houses so that neighbors won't start to notice what's going on and so on. And then the time has come for the hit itself. And so when the hit is done, when the shots are fired, only thing that is important for them at that point is that the victim has to die. So there's more or less always multiple shooters, triangular fire or backup shooters, so that if the first one fails, a secondary or third option would be available. And also around the crime scene when it happens, there will be fake police cars, or they're real police cars, but they will be off duty. And the people in these police cars are part of the whole operation. Their task is to stop if there's any kind of a brave, normal person in the street who sees what happens and starts chasing them. Their task will then be to stop this guy, because the main thing is that a hit is done and that the hit team gets out of the way, that they are let out. So you will see a repeated pattern of that when the shots are fired, if this is a massive conspiracy, then they will shut down the telephone and the communication system for mobiles as well in the area, so that it will only be the official story that will be spread out. This will then later be blamed on that, everybody was trying to call each other and tell about this strategy, and that is why the whole system was just overloaded. Absolutely not true. They did this with JFK, where the whole national telephone system was shut down for 1 hour in the whole of the United States. 9/11, you had the same, the 7/7 bombings in London, you had the same, and so on. It's a repeated thing that they do to control the information going out from the crime scene. Okay, so the shots are fired, the person is killed, they make sure that he's dead, and then if a normal crime is committed, then the police would be very active, they would be very fast to get on location and so on. When these things are carried out, it's like everything goes, shuts down, like in on stand down mode or slow motion, and everything is slowed down. No police cars are arriving until the hit team has cleared the site. You know, they're off, they're fine, they're safe. Boom! Then the police moves in, and then they start a great hunt, looking, you know, in all the wrong places to start with. Until they've got a clear sign that, okay, the team is okay, they're out of sight, and then the whole thing starts pointing straight at the patsy, divert the attention away from what actually happened and blame it on the patsy.
Wow. And what's the mainstream media's role in this? Is it just after the fact? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Sorry, could you say that again, please?
Mainstream media's role in this? Is it just after the fact that basically they're just fed the press releases and they just regurgitate it? Do they have any active part in this, or are they just simply passively repeating what they're told?
This is the thing. They think that they are free press. I tell you, I used to be a journalist, and I think most journalists believe that they're doing a good job, that they are free thinkers and that they're critical thinkers and good journalists. But I tell you, that is not my experience. My experience is that you go there, you get the official story, and you just repeat it. You just pump it out there without any criticism or critical thought. And then also nowadays, journalists are so overloaded with work, so they're not allowed to get the amount of time they need to really dig into these kind of cases, because the ownership of more or less all media today is connected to this group. So through the what do you call it, the not the directors, but the
secret society,
what is that called in English? No, but the guy who's in charge of that newspaper, the chief editor,
the
or whatever he's called.
Call him the publisher usually.
Yeah, it goes down through the hidden power pyramid, from the owner down to the publisher, down to the editor, and so on. And then, because these are the people they control, they don't have to control the journalist down on the office floor. They can just divert him, you know, keep him busy with other stuff. So normal journalists are never really allowed to look into these things. And this is also what you see. There's hardly any normal journalist doing any of this important work. It's all left to ordinary people, you know, to find out the real truth.
Yeah. It's interesting. Mm-hmm.
No, then if people don't buy this thing with the lone patsy, and there's a big enough opposition or criticizing this whole thing, then in the end they will say, okay, fine, we will put a truth commission, or they always give them a fancy name, you know, the truth and liberation for the population opinion commission or something like that, to find out the real truth, you know. And but their task is that they are actually part of the crime itself. And they're there to cover it up. Their task is to look into the investigation, not the crime, but into the investigation. And they will then drag it out for a year or so, pumping out absolute boring articles in the newspaper and media, making people so fed up with the whole thing. There will also be some local scandals maybe in the commission, making them have to sack one of the members in the commission and get a new one in, and they will then use that as a reason to drag it out for a couple of months more, because they have to update this new member of what's going on. So they drag it out, and then they present a report. It will be like 1,000 pages saying absolute zero, and the official statement will be that, the investigation really did a good job. It was the Patsy for sure. They did make some mistakes. We pointed it out. We've done a great job, and that's it. And by then, the normal guy in the street will be so fed up with the whole thing that he won't even look at it anymore. Mm-hmm. Should this continue, like around the Swedish, the assassination of the Swedish Prime Minister, we've had three different commissions looking into each other, you know, and it's just drag it out. And now normal people don't care. They couldn't care less. And they don't understand, like, for instance, in Sweden, that what happened was a coup d'etat in slow motion, and that the people that took him out the people that are still in power, messing the lives of the population up without them knowing why. And this is exactly the same what happened with JFK. It's actually the same power elite behind both these assassinations and so many more. And it was in the States as well, it was a coup d'etat. It was a bloody murder of an elected president. I would humbly suggest that he's the last real elected president was JFK, even though there was some fiddling around with the Chicago mob involved in his election as well. But I would suggest that all the president that has been elected, so-called elected ever since, I would call it selected, are just a different face of the same power elite, the same war machine that took over that day, the 22nd of November 1963, that have stayed in power to this very day. Yeah. That is why I think it's so important to expose what happened there, because it's still going on.
Excellent. One thing I wanted to get back to silent coup issue, but I wanted to go over something else. Let's say, ideally, they probably kill the Patsy, like, immediately. There's two possibilities. Either they kill the Patsy immediately, or the Patsy, you know, survives and goes on trial. How do they handle each of those two things? Well, who would actually kill the Patsy? And is it just like a mistake if the Patsy somehow lives? And how do they deal with it if the Patsy, you know, goes on trial? How do they deal with those cases with the Patsy? So, I mean, they've now committed the murder. I guess hit team gets away. Now they have the Patsy. Now they either have to kill the Patsy or they don't kill him. I don't know if that's a mistake in their case. And how do they deal with it if they fail to kill the Patsy and he goes on trial?
The thing is, they have very little respect for normal people, because we, and I can understand them, because we have been so asleep for such a long time that they've been able to get away with absolute ridiculous things. I mean, many of these assassinations and so-called terror acts are absolute no-brainers. You don't have to be very intelligent to, if you look at it with objectively, it would be within minutes you will see, oh my God, it's a conspiracy, and then you should wake up and start looking at this crime in a totally different way. But we have been buying into this for so many years, so they have absolutely no respect for us. They don't see us as a threat almost, or at least they didn't in the old days. When it comes to the Patsy, the trial that follows are totally rigged. Absolutely, totally rigged. And you will see that very often this Patsy, he's given a trial like 3-4 hours and boom, that's it, you know, very quickly, 10 hours maybe, no witnesses to for his protection. Everybody's just, he's the guy, and then poof, he's put away to rot. And so there's quite a few totally innocent people that have spent most of their adult life in prison still, accused of crimes they had absolutely nothing to do with.
I see. First of all, oftentimes they use patsies. There are people like mentally ill or mind controlled. I'm thinking of like James Holmes at the Colorado shooting, where the guy looked so out of it he probably couldn't tie his shoes, to be quite honest. So they're so out of it that they couldn't even stand for themselves if they wanted to. When the Patsy lives, is that a mistake on their part, or do they sometimes intentionally allow the Patsy to live? I mean, because it seems like it's a dangerous thing to have a living Patsy.
When the Patsy is mind controlled, like Sirhan Sirhan or Mark Chapman, it's not a risk for them at all because they were programmed before the event. You will see that they behave very similar before and after the shooting. And their memory, they have absolutely no recollection of the crime itself, what happened. It's totally blank. And just after the crime has been committed, they stand like zombies. They just wait to be picked up. They have, and then once they talk about this thing in trial and afterwards, maybe 20 years down the line when they start giving interviews, it's like a recorded story. The same wording, the same comes out exactly the same more or less every single time. But these patsies, if you look, for instance, at Robert Kennedy, that is an absolute no-brainer. You have Sirhan Sirhan that was accused of having done it. He had a revolver, a 22, with 8 bullets. Yeah. Okay. He comes. The closest he is in front. He is to Robert Kennedy is a meter and a half, a meter 30, something like that. Mm-hmm. And as soon as he starts shooting, because he did shoot. As soon as he starts shooting, he was jumped by people surrounding him, and they managed to get the gun away from him. But so you look at it, 8 bullets. How many was fired? There's a lot of proofs showing that there might have been fired as many as 12 to 13 shots in that little kitchen. And so you look at, of course, if Sirhan Sirhan was standing right in front of him, Robert Kennedy was hit all 3 times straight from the front. Absolutely not. He was hit from the back and to the right. And the last shot, the head shot, was point blank. The barrel of the gun was all the way up against his skull, so his hair was burned away. So it's a no-brainer. It is absolutely impossible for Sirhan Sirhan to have been the one that actually killed Robert Kennedy. The real shooter was behind and to the right.
Yes.
So here we come to the next level. So who was behind him and to the right? That's the whole thing. But to this very day, we've been told, no, it was Sirhan, Sirhan, Sirhan. And all evidence, I mean, thousands of photos that was taken in that kitchen and so on, was burnt. And this is also standard proceeding with these major assassinations. Evidence is totally destroyed, manipulated, getting rid of. All type of normal, honest detective work is just non-existing.
Well, that's also a very important point. And I know at the trial, the thing is, it was the defense attorney, who might have been in on it, by the way, didn't point out that the bullets recovered from Kennedy were from a different caliber gun than the gun that Sirhan Sirhan. And this is like defense attorney 101 stuff. This is, you can't get more basic than this. If you're defending someone from a murder charge, if you point out, wait a minute, this guy had a 22 and the bullets were like 45s or something, you know, that they had to come from another gun. And so one is, I suppose, that maybe in some cases the defense attorney's in on it. Two, they have such contempt for us that they would have something where they'd have a gun with 8 bullets, but they'd fire 15 shots because they figure no one, you know, that the public is so dumbed down that they're not going to see such thing, something like that's an obvious sloppiness. Because you'd think, well, they know that the Patsy's only got an 8-gun bullet. Why not an 8-bullet gun? Well, we better only fire 8 shots or less. So is it just that they have such a contempt? From what I'm hearing, it's like, first of all, they allow the Patsy to live because they killed the Patsy every time. That would get fishy in and of itself, but the Patsy's so mind-controlled they can't say anything. The actual assassination will be very sloppy because they basically have such a deep contempt. 15 bullets will be fired, even though the gun only had 8 shots. And then they have, like, a defense attorney who might very well be in on it, too, who won't point out an obvious thing like, wait a minute, you know, the caliber on the gun is wrong.
I think more or less always the attorney is in on it. You know, these trials are rigged. They're prepared beforehand, just like the investigation. It's people that they control, and it's just rigged. And the only thing is to get the Patsy in jail. And if there was a very clear pattern of them getting killed every single time, you would have a problem. But that's why they do it, you know, if they're mind-controlled, just get them in there behind bars and make it very difficult for journalists to approach them or get access to them. And then they just let them rot away and keep pumping out the official story. I mean, Sirhan, totally innocent guy, was put away 1968. He is still in there when it's so obvious that he is totally, totally, totally innocent. He
yes.
had nothing to do with it.
It's interesting.
My 9-year-old daughter can tell you, you know, I showed the evidence. She said, but Dad, that's impossible. I say, yeah, it is.
Well, and it's because they have such contempt for us that there would be obvious mismatches. Now, certainly there would have to be some mismatches, but like having 15 shots fired when there's only eight bullets in the gun, that's because they have such basic contempt, they figure we can get away with anything. So we can have even the most obvious mismatches, and 9/11 is a great example. It's absolutely full of things that are utterly ridiculous. Yeah. Even, you know, it's laughable, especially like World Trade Center 7. By the way, anyone who thinks the 9/11 story is true, Google World Trade Center 7, explain how a 47-story building fell straight into its own footprint, you know, when it wasn't even hit by a plane, although that wouldn't have caused it to happen either, but that's another story. But so essentially what we have happen is then when the Patsy does live, they're mind-controlled, the defense attorney is in on it, there will be certain anomalies, but they're so used to getting away with anything that they that these anomalies are they're covered up basically, and because there have to be some anomalies just by the nature of things, because obviously the bullet trajectories are going to be different and than where the you know the Patsy was and so forth. Now, when you talk about
I just wanted to say the truth is very simple. You know, something happens. The truth is the truth. You don't have to manipulate it. It's very simple, straightforward. That happened. But once you have a conspiracy behind it, and the more people involved in it, the more lies, the more people have to cover the whole thing, even more lies are involved, then, you know, who can we trust? You know, okay, maybe he will become a whistleblower. They start killing off each other inside it, more fear, more lies, and it's just become a major mess. But these
sure.
people have been untouchables for such a long time that I mean, like Henry Kissinger so poetically put it, they see us as useless eaters, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's the way they deal with it.
Sure. Except for to pay the bills and to provide the brain power and muscle power to bring their evil system in. But, you know, we're useless except for we're the ones who are actually, you know, spending the time, money, and energy to create all this stuff for them. But that's another story. Now, you talk about these being silent coups, and I can see, like, with JFK, I guess they wanted to have LBJ in because he was being more compliant. I know that in the case of JFK, he wanted to bring he was going against the Fed by wanting to bring in money that was without needing the Fed, which, you know, just like Lincoln, who also died a very similar death, it could very well have been part of that same pattern. And, you know, he wanted in the Vietnam War, which was, you know, the CIA was using to bring in tons of drugs and no doubt many other things. So, but you're saying when these are done at the high level, they're really silent coups. It's really about basically like a change of leadership in some form or the other. Is that correct? Could you expand on that?
Totally. Totally.
Okay.
And, also, sometimes they statue an example. I mean, JFK was a perfect example of that, because they could very easily have slipped a pill in his coffee or something like that, and he would have died of a so-called heart attack. But instead, what they wanted was to make a statement, you know, to show people in power, we can take out anyone at any time, anywhere, so you better back off and shut up. And that was what was spread out. This is... Also, when you see many of these conspiracies, there's almost always like a secondary conspiracy of silence that follows this. From the official point of view, you know, in governments and so on, silence. It's the official story, nothing else. And this silence is due to the fact that people in so-called power positions, I mean, way below this real elite, they know... Maybe they don't know the details about that assassination, but they know the power behind it, and they know that if they start speaking out or becoming too critical, they can be the next in line.
Sure.
But when it comes to one thing that I would very much like to describe is it's a group called Operation 40.
Okay.
Most people have never heard about them, and I would say that they are so central in world history that it's very important to expose them.
Okay.
This was a group that was created in the late 50s, early 1960s, when President Dwight Eisenhower was in power. The idea was formed by people like the chief of the CIA and the director of the CIA, Alan Dulles, and other people. And what they wanted was to create a team of super assassins that could be used to take out leaders or enemies globally. Whoever they had problems with, they could just use this team of assassins. And the task to create this was given to Vice President Richard Nixon.
Mm.
Richard Nixon then contracted some people from the CIA, people like Ted Shackley, also known as the Blonde Ghost, later one of the highest one in the CIA when it came to covert operations in the Western Hemisphere. I mean, big time player, Ted Shackley. Another person was E. Howard Hunt, which is quite known around the JFK assassination and many other assassinations as well. And a third one was David Attlee Phillips. David Attlee Phillips is a very, very interesting character, or very central in this whole thing. He was, among other things, he was an expert on propaganda, how to manipulate media, and he was the CIA's station chief in Mexico City just before the JFK assassination. And he was actually the controller of Lee Harvey Oswald, the Patsy Lee Harvey Oswald, who took the fall for the JFK assassination. Absolutely innocent guy that I would humbly suggest that Oswald was actually a hero, because he really, really tried to expose that there was an assassination attempt going down. He was the one sending out the telegrams to the FBI offices and so on, trying to stop the whole thing, because he was involved in it, but not as taking part of it. He just knew about it. But anyway, David Attlee Phillips was the controller of Lee Harvey Oswald. He was the one that painted him totally black and prepared him as a patsy. He was also the controller of one of the shooters that took out JFK, a man by the name of James Files, who was behind the picket fence and who was the one that fired the final headshot. He was also the controller of another man that has become very, very central in countless assassinations globally, a man by the name of Michael Vernon Townley. Michael Vernon Townley was the son of a CIA boss, a Ford executive director in Chile, and he was hired by the CIA early on and then trained as an assassin, and he was part of the overtake of Salvador Allende, as well as this team, Operation 40, that I'm going to go into more detail about. But mm-hmm. he was also part of blowing up Orlando Letelier, together with other members of Operation 40 in Washington, D.C. It was a car bomb in Embassy Row. That was the biggest national terrorist act before 9/11. He was also, for instance, in South Africa, where he killed a man by the name of Robert Smith. That is a major political mystery in South Africa. And he was on location 23 years later when the Swedish Prime Minister, Olof Palme, was shot in the streets of Stockholm. So the same key players have been around for a long time, and all of them, or many of them, being tracked back to this group of assassins. Anyway, so this group was created. It consisted mostly of people that were recruited in Miami, and more or less all of them exiled Cubans that had just escaped from Cuba when Fidel Castro took over. It was military people from the Air Force, former police officers, former secret agents under the Batista regime and so on. And they were recruited by these CIA people, then trained in New Orleans, and in Miami, and down in Florida, down in the swamps down there, and also in Guatemala. They were training all different type of assassins, you name it, bazookas, jungle warfare, poison, you name it. They were getting the training for it. The paymaster for this group is a very interesting person by the name of George Herbert Walker Bush. That's George Bush Sr. At that time, he was a very young guy, just about to be connected with the CIA and so on. And he was given the task to be the one that funneled the funds into this group. The funds were coming from like the military industrial complex, from the mob, from companies like Standard Oil or United Fruits and so on, and pumped into this group so that they could be armed and trained and whatever, equipped in any necessary way. George Herbert Walker Bush, I just want to mention that his father was Prescott Bush, and he was doing, Prescott Bush was doing the exact same thing, but for Hitler, where he was the guy who, for this elite, funded the Nazi war machine. They also funded the other sides in this war, but Prescott Bush was the one that brought the funds to Adolf Hitler. And some of the lawyers that helped Adolf Hitler as well, one of them were Alan Dulles and his brother, John Foster Dulles, that later became very central in the JFK assassination and the whole build-up of the CIA. So we see the same people popping up again and again.
Mm-hmm.
So George Herbert Walker Bush, who's been extremely, extremely central in all, in so many assassinations and atrocities against humankind, I would say, ever since the 1963 and onwards, was the paymaster of this group. The man put as his right hand was a man by the name of Felix Rodriguez. Felix Rodriguez was later one of the key people in operation in the Iran-Contra scandal, where weapons were taken from the National Guard and then flown out in military planes, medical planes, some of them big C-133s or C-130s, by pilots like Barry Seals, member of Operation 40, Chip Tatum, a CIA whistleblower nowadays, Tosh Plumlee, who's also a member of Operation 40 and so on. They flew these weapons down to the Contra, the army that was created by the CIA with a big input by Henry Kissinger, who's another very, very central person in all of this mayhem. And they flew them down there to arm the Contras so that they could just commit total genocide in countries like El Salvador, Nicaragua, Honduras, and so on. And then when these planes returned, they returned with a big cargo of raw cocaine. And okay. so on. And with that, the whole crack epidemic was starting in the United States.
Yes, I know that was reported.
One of the airstrips they used to start with was in Arkansas, a small little town called Mena, and they used the airstrip to transport the drugs in there. And at that point in time, there was a quite unknown governor by the name of Bill Clinton. Now, Bill Clinton and his partner, Dan Lasseter, were personally receiving a lot of these drugs. They've been filmed by Chip Tatum and other people receiving it together with George Bush Sr. I mean, we're talking receiving it, putting hands on, and then being part of distributing it across the states to the Cribs in L.A. And many, many other areas, all with the intention of making absolute billions, but also to destabilize the American society, get the crime rights off, get the minorities to start shooting each other, killing each other, and at the same time make heavy investments in private prisons. That is another major income to this this group. And this is also why they are so aimed at getting criminals in prison. I mean, now you steal an apple, boom, you're off for life or something like that. They make absolute bundles of that. Slave labor. Now they get in there, and like you say, now they're doing more and more labor. And every single prisoner is paid for by the taxpayer. Every single bomb that are being dropped on an innocent country, paid by the taxpayer. Every plane, every whatever you name it, every single time, is the taxpayers who have to pay. But this Operation 40 has been extremely central in so many different historical events. There was, in the JFK assassination, I can name all the shooters, spotters, breakdown guys, walkie-talkie guys, who drove the cars and so on. But a major part of this assassination were done by members of Operation 40. And one of them, he was not a shooter, he was one of the guys who drove one of the escape cars. His name was David Morales. He was later named the top assassin of Latin America, a very violent man, extremely violent, high up in the CIA. And not only was he present in Dealey Plaza when JFK was taken out, he was also one of the supervisors in the Ambassador Hotel together with two other high officials, CIA officials, when Robert Kennedy was taken out. He was also sent together with Felix Rodriguez, who I mentioned before, down to Bolivia to track down and assassinate Che Guevara, who was one of Fidel Castro's closest friends. And they used some local military patrol, managed
Guevara?
To track Che.
Sorry,
could you say that?
Why did they assassinate Guevara? Wasn't he this... I mean, he was a banker frontman, wasn't he? He was a communist revolutionary. Why did they assassinate him? It seems like he was doing what they wanted.
No, they wanted to get rid of Fidel Castro. They really wanted to kill him, and they wanted to kill everyone connected to him, everyone that gave him power. And he, Che Guevara, was becoming like a symbol. That is also why you see him on posters and T-shirts, mm-hmm. prints to this very day. So they really wanted to get rid of him.
Well, no, was Guevara actually a good man? Or, I mean, was Castro trying to do the right thing? Why did they want to get rid of Guevara and Castro?
It is a hard question to answer. I think that that Fidel Castro, from my point of view, started out good. His intention was to get Cuba back to the Cubans, you know, to kick out the mob, to kick out all organized crime, because at that point in the late 50s, Cuba was used as a haven, you know, for you had, I think, Las Vegas and Atlantic City together, that much kind of casinos and all of these things, lots of drug trading going on, and the whole country was just being swallowed by this elite group. So when Fidel Castro came and just said, enough is enough, and he just threw everybody out and said, Cuba is for the Cubans. He
and
threw
that's why
out
they wanted
the big,
to get rid of him and Guevara.
They wanted to get rid of Che Guevara and get back into Cuba, but they didn't manage. And I think to start with, Fidel Castro was a man with big morals and big dreams and all of these things, together with his friend Che Guevara, and they were revolutionaries. But I think then over the years, power corrupts. That is
standard
thing.
Yeah, he became very corrupt.
And people, leaders, become dictators, you know.
Well, once you get back to what you're talking about, I didn't mean to interrupt you there. I'm just a little curious about that. So they went to track down Guevara, and then because you're connecting with and that was in, 68 or something like that. Okay, I'm sorry,
yeah,
I didn't mean to interrupt you there.
And Che Guevara, Felix Rodriguez was the one that ordered him killed, and David Morales was the one that shot him. And to this very day, Felix Rodriguez is very proudly showing Che Guevara's watch that he carries around. And but these are also members of Operation 40 are also the Watergate burglars. The people involved in the Watergate burglary was sent there from Richard Nixon. He was the guy who was trying to get them to cover all tracks that would point him back to being involved in the JFK assassination, because he was deeply involved, as was Lyndon Johnson, as was J. Edgar Hoover, and many, many other people. This was the hit on JFK was a coalition, an unholy alliance between the military-industrial complex, oil tycoons, rogue elements within the government, the CIA, Secret Service, the Dallas Police, and the Chicago mob, not only the Chicago mob, but also in Louisiana and Miami, New York, they were also involved. And one of the things they did was that everybody, just like in the case of when they killed Julius Caesar, everybody had to dip their hands in blood so that nobody could point a blaming finger on any of the other ones. So all the different elements had to supply shooters.
Sure. I have a question.
Sorry?
Now, was like the original assassination temple, is that like Julius Caesar? Because you talked about going back to Roman times. Do they use the same basic template even way back then?
That's what I'm saying. Many of these templates were used by the Romans and perfected by the Romans, and then they've just been using the same. The same.
Another question I have, it seems if you're becoming an assassination, you'd want as few shooters as possible, as few people involved. I mean, you'd want to keep the numbers down to an absolute minimum. Granted, if you're talking about the murder of a president, it's going to take, obviously, if you're talking about the murder of just an ordinary person, can be one person. But if you're talking the murder of someone where they got security and you have to do cover-ups and you have press and all this, I get that you're going to need to have a whole team, but it seems that they had a lot more people involved than they needed to. I mean, if you're getting to the point of having a paymaster, it seems like you'd be wanting to keep the number of people involved to as few as possible, wouldn't you?
It depends on if you think that you fear anything or you're threatened in any way. But these people often walk around very openly with walkie-talkies. They don't try to hide their weapons and so on, like around the JFK assassin, very openly, because they know they're going to get away. They know they have total cover. They know they will never be sentenced for the crime and so on. But it's different when you have operations, the different type of operations, where you really fear that the public eye will be watching you. Mm-hmm. So, but what they do quite often also is that it's not only one team that is on location. They have several teams, and the different teams are not aware of the other ones. So that once somebody like myself start looking into it, it will just point everywhere, all over the place. And
yeah,
become,
like a fake
this is what I mean by
attempt,
most. Sorry?
They're like a fake assassination attempt where they'll put in, even at the time of the assassination, they'll already have the fake evidence, they'll have the red herring. So wouldn't E. Howard Hunt or something involve like some kind of fake assassination attempt to test the security or something? Where they'll do things like that so that way confuse people. So that's why they have a lot of people involved too.
The JFK assassination was named the big event. And when you look at Dealey Plaza, because the official version was, or the official idea was that he would go from straight from downtown Dallas and straight through Dallas down on Main Street, straight up in the middle of Dealey Plaza, and then to the World Trade Center where he was going to give a speech. But what they did in Dealey Plaza, what they made this awful turn off route. Onto Houston Street, a 90-degree turn, and then straight after that, a 120-degree turn to the left down Elm Street, making an absolute awful crime against security measures,
Sure.
Slowing the whole thing down, opening him up for all this crossfire. This is why Dealey Plaza is so interesting to study, because all normal people that did not know about what was going down would not have been standing in front of the school book depository. They would not be standing on Houston Street. They would be standing along Main Street, which is where the motorcade was supposed to go.
So
that is why it's so important to study all these photos, because you will find a multitude of assassins there, that was not involved, but they were just there, like Freddie Lugo. You had Orlando Bosch, you had Frank Sturgis, you had many, many, many very heavyweight assassins that were there, but almost like spectators, And
yeah.
I think it's almost like, when there's a big rock concert, a major rock star is coming to the capital city of some country, that country's rock stars will also go to that concert to see it. And it was almost like there were so many people aware of it within the in these assassination, what do you call it, networks. They knew that something was going down. So either if they were positioned there or they came by themselves, I don't know, but there's a multitude of people there in Dealey Plaza with very incredible contacts when it came to assassins.
One thing I've heard, I don't have the exact quote, but I'm paraphrasing it, was that the people behind the assassination are those that controlled security and were able to change it around at the last minute. I know, like with RFK, where they had him go a different route, or just like with JFK, where they redirect his motorcade and they allow the assassination to happen. They might not know all the details, but they're basically told, probably by these elites, that you will stand down on security. You will redirect, you know, JFK's motorcade here. You will send RFK through this way, where they allow the assassination to happen by changing security so it can happen. Are you familiar with that?
Standard procedure. And it, very often the people who redirect the route don't even know why they're doing it. You know, they don't understand the... They just, you know, totally compartmentalized. They just, okay, fine, no problem, I stand down. You know, that is why in Dallas, for instance, the motorcade, normally JFK would have had like a bulletproof bubble top on the limo. Mm-hmm. That was taken off. He would have bodyguard. The limo that he was coming in would be in the middle of the whole motorcade. Now it was the second vehicle, just behind the front car. The press car would normally be right in front of the limousine so that they could film the president waving and all of these things. Now that would put way back down. He would also have his private physician, you know, his private doctor, very close by should anything happen. He was put way back in the end of the whole motorcade. There would be motorcycles on the sides, and before, after, and on the sides to make it more difficult for shooters. All of these were pulled back to the third car.
Yeah, there were no people on the sides of his car, because usually they'd have people walking beside his car or actually on the car.
You would have secret service agents on the sides, on the back of the car, ready to go into action at any second. This time, all of them were on the third car, you know. They were being pulled back. And this is also standard procedure, that this poor sod that is going to go to heaven soon, he will just be stripped for all type of security. Bodyguards will be pulled away. The bodyguards not knowing, you know, they will just follow order. Okay, fine, I stand down. Because they've been informed maybe that there are some other security measures taken or something like that. But in this case, absolutely not. And then once it's done, it's too late to say anything, and then they shut up because they will only point themselves out, you know, having done an awful job and being partly responsible of being involved in the assassination itself. So it's a very ugly story, these type of assassinations. Very, very cowardly done.
Yeah, exactly. So you're talking about Operation 40, and you're talking about how it's been kind of this parasitic group has been moving through history, doing all these horrible things, and you're talking, I think, you're up to MENA, Arkansas, and our friend Bill Clinton running the drugs, and you're talking about, I know people like Barry Seal, who I believe subsequently died, was one of the drug couriers. Now, I want you to kind of continue the story of Operation 40, leaving off from, I think, you're in the 1980s, because I wanted to kind of hear how they moved through history, and what this group has done, and if it's changed its name since then, and you know, what you know about them now.
Okay, Barry, I just want to mention that Barry Seals was taken out 1 week before the Swedish Prime Minister in the early 1986, and he was just about to give testimony about George Herbert Walker Bush, about his involvement in the whole thing, and then he was gunned down in Baton Rouge in Louisiana, apparently by... drug couriers. I mean, absolutely not. This was not the guy, the people that were behind it, the power behind it, Bush and his pals. I can guarantee you that. Mm-hmm. And also, Olof Palme, the Swedish Prime Minister, was also connected to these illegal arms, illegal arms trafficking that was going on globally. And Barry Seals, it seems like he was the first one in a long row of people that were being cleaned out. that were connected to these arms deals. And one of the reasons why the Swedish Prime Minister was taken out was because Oliver North, if you remember him, the guy in the uniform looking all proud and honest, very deeply involved in the Iran-Contras together with George Bush Sr.
But we have no relation to Oliver North. Okay, anyways. Okay.
Sorry?
I said no relationship to Oliver North. So. Okay, anyway, so you're talking about Oliver North, okay.
I totally talk about Oliver North.
Okay.
And he had approached the Swedish Prime Minister wanting to give him, fake different manufacturer certificates when it came to some missiles and so. And one of the things they did with these illegal arms trading was that, for instance, because international law says that some companies are not, you're not allowed to sell weapons to countries that are involved in war, as especially a neutral country like Sweden, who has a very big weapons industry, even though it's neutral, they cannot sell directly to a country at war. So instead, what happened was that Sweden was selling it to what they called green countries. If we say that the warfaring countries are red, as you're not allowed to, they instead sold them to green countries. But then what they did was they sold the weapons to so-called green legal countries. But in that country, there were different rules, so they just changed the certificate of the manufacturer so that in the long run, they sent these weapons like in a zigzag globally, and then it ended up in countries at war, like doing awful things, you know, to the local population or blowing the enemy up big time. And Oliver North tried to force Olof Palme to fix some of these user certificates, and he refused. And that was one of the final nails in his coffin that got them to take him out. But he was just Barry Seals, and then Olof Palme was just the first in a long row of people killed in Germany and many other countries where with connections to these arms deals. But when it comes to Operation 40, you want to hear more about them. One of the things that I asked once, because I did an interview with one of the guys, and I said, but how come the same people again and again and again? And he said, but why change a winning team? And I think that's a very good point. I mean, if you if you have a computer company and you got a really skilled team of technicians who can sort out everything, anything, you stick to them. You know, here they have a really good team of mechanics that can deal with anything, you know, blow planes up, do whatever. So they just stuck with them. They just continued with them. And Operation 40 has been called the grandmother of all operations. They were the core group that sort of started this whole trend. And over the decades, this group has changed names many times in different constellations and so on, and also expanded into many other hit teams and constellations of mercenaries and assassins and so on. But the core people have been very, very active, and some of them are still around, even though they're getting quite old now. So a very, very central group to study.
Yeah. Well, I know also... So basically, it's obviously changed names, just like you have Blackwater Chi Academy. I think now they're called Greystone or something. They keep changing their names to basically hide it from investigators as to who they are.
I wonder why.
Sure. No, it makes total sense. Now, I'm curious. So a lot of books have been written about the JFK assassination. First of all, what do you think of the movie JFK by Oliver Stone? Do you think that was accurate, or was that disinformation, or what exactly was that?
No, I think it was an absolutely amazing film, very accurate, even though the truth is even bigger than that. But I think it's a very, very, very good film. It's just a pity that they've done the editing almost like a rock video, because it's so complicated anyway for people to understand that it makes it even more confusing. But I think excellent, excellent work.
Yeah, well, I know at the end of it, there was a 15-minute soliloquy by Kevin Costner, kind of trying to connect all the dots and explain the whole thing work. And to have an actor speaking for 15 minutes straight in a movie is almost unprecedented. But it was just trying to kind of connect the whole thing together in the Clay Shaw trial. I understand Bush was also involved in Cambodia, wasn't he, with Pol Pot? I mean, when he was ambassador to China?
That part I don't know for sure, so I prefer not saying about it.
I understand. Anyway, Operation 40, so it's been going along, basically, it's kind of the ultimate enforcement arm of, like, the globalists of the New World Order, essentially, doing basically high-level assassinations and high-level terrorism. Would that be an accurate assessment?
Yep.
And it's probably no doubt expanded. There's been subgroups under it that have been involved in basically changing history, mostly through high-level murders of various people who, for whatever reason, were a threat to it. I'm curious, was Princess Diana one of these people?
She was taken out. I believe the... I'm like, you can cut off my right arm if you want. If it was not an assassination, it was a spot-on assassination carried out. But I believe that the reason why she was taken out was because she was, once again, one of these people who has the spotlight, and who, when she says something, when she did something, millions and millions and millions of people listened. And especially with Diana, this was a group that were... normally not a problem, because there were all these housewives, millions and millions of housewives that just worshipped the ground she was walking on. But she became a major problem because she started knowing too much of the secrets from the English royal, you know, the royal family.
Yeah, and they got lots of secrets.
But also because she was so against landmines. And landmines is a very essential tool for this power elite, because one of the things they do with landmines is they first create a problem. This is an old Roman tactic I can talk about also: problem, reaction, solution.
Mm-hmm.
They secretly create a problem to get a reaction from the public, and the reaction they always want is an emotional saying, "Oh my God, something needs to be done." Emotional, because they don't want people to use their normal brain. And then in that situation where people are just screaming for help, then boom, in they move with their solution that the population would never have accepted had it not been for the problem that people are not aware of, that I was the one creating. And so many of these wars and invasions of absolute innocent countries are due to the fact that they want to invade these countries for drugs, for minerals, for sometimes it's because of the strategic location of that country. They need airstrips and so on. So one of the ways, especially when it comes to drugs and oil and minerals and so on, they want the local population out of the way so that there's no they can do whatever they want. And the way they do that is they invade the country, and then they put out all these awful, awful landmines, some of them even disguised as toys and so on. So the local population, the kids go around and, oh, look at a toy, and then, boom, they blow them up. But they don't blow them up so they die. It's awful. It really is awful. They blow them up so that they get maimed, you know, a leg, an arm, and so on. That would really occupy... and make a major burden to the population. So the population is scared off from that area that they want to have for themselves. And then also media, everybody, nobody dares to go there except on these special routes where they would go with the armed escort to control them if they're even allowed in there. So the landmine is a very, very strong tool in their agenda. And I think when Lady Di started going so hard up against this, that was when she signed her own death certificate.
Very well could be. One thing also about landmines, now that you mention it, is that with Agenda 21, the idea of clearing people off the land to put us all in high settlement zones, a very efficient way of doing it is through landmines. So I could imagine, I mean, you've got Diana, who was far and away the most famous woman on the face of the earth, when she put all this attention on it, because that's a very efficient way of getting people off the land. And like I said, with Agenda 20, it fits in with the global agenda. One thing I also want to talk to you about is you when we were emailing each other, you mentioned three very famous singers, Jimi Hendrix, Whitney Houston, and Bob Marley, who you believe were assassinated. I know, of course, there's the famous 27 Club, of which Amy Winehouse is the most recent member. And I don't know how many of these members of this, you know, famous 27 Club, also like of course Jim Morrison, have been met their hands through foul play, or how many of them were just simple drug addiction. And if you could comment on their deaths, I mean, especially with Whitney Houston, because I thought that was just drugs. And in the case of, I mean, I thought that Janis Joplin being another member, I thought that like I don't know if you could comment on their deaths and. Were any of them deaths due to their, you know, drug habits, or were they all assassinations?
All of them are being blamed on drug habits, and they are not. I tell you, they are not. When it comes to, I can start with Jimmy, and then Bob, and then
sure.
John Lennon, and then Whitney Houston, if we take it
okay,
in that.
Okay, good. Yeah, I'm sure they're all
Jimi
related.
Hendrix,
yes.
Mm-hmm. Jimi Hendrix was, I cannot swear to who killed him, but I know that he knew that he was a dead man about a year before he died. He knew that he was stepping on some very sore toes and that he was upsetting a lot of people. He was, I think one of the things he did was, when he came forward, he was the first black musician really being, entering the rock scene, you know, and being, suddenly the spotlight was so on him. And when he went to England, one of the things he did, he was only 24, 25, you know, when he became famous, a young, young guy. And one of the things he did was that he started supporting the Black Panther movement. In the mid-60s, this was a major thing for this elite with the FBI in the front line to stop them, you know, to get rid of Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, anyone that was connected to the Black Panther movement and so on. And Jimmy started supporting them. If that is the reason why he was taken out, I don't know. But what I do know is that he was murdered. He also had a lot of problems with his manager Mike Jeffries that he accused of having swindled a lot of money and so on. But when you look at his death itself, there are very, very many weird things going on. And the official story is that he was with a new girlfriend. Her name was Monica Dannemann, a German woman, and they had been out for a few days and so on. Then came home, and they went asleep. And then she went out to get some cigarettes and so on. When she came back, he was dying. So she called the ambulance, and they came, picked him up, and brought her with them. They went to the hospital, and he was declared dead. Now, the thing is that this version keeps changing. It kept changing. She gave multiple different variations of this. And the people that drove the ambulance say that she was not there at all. But they arrived to the hotel room and they found this dead black person, and they had no idea it was Jimi Hendrix. And they took him to the hospital, and if you speak to the doctors, what they said is, yes, he was dead on arrival, but his lungs were totally filled with red wine. There was no very, very little alcohol percentage in his blood, meaning that he died before the body could absorb the alcohol. So how could he get his lungs filled with red wine without drinking it? And you cannot drink that much by yourself, you know, getting it down into the lungs. The only way this is possible is if somebody holds you down and just pump you up with red wine, you know. So that was the way that they killed him. Somebody held him down and just forced this down into his lungs, so he drowned in red wine. Mike Jeffries later died under weird circumstances. He was in a mid-air crash, airplane crash over France. And Monica Dannemann was later brought to trial. She made a whole career around her friendship with Jimi Hendrix as a painter and so on. And then there was a court case with another girlfriend of Jimi Hendrix. And I think the power behind this assassination may have been very fearful of her coming to to court because, you know, emotional women with dark secrets and getting into a very tense situation could start talking. So when the time for this trial came, she came out and she was found dead in a garage. She had killed herself inside a car, you know, with a tube from the exhaust into the tongue. Possible suicide? I don't know. Not. I just know that around these assassinations or strange deaths, there's a long string normally followed by people committing suicides, jumping from buildings. You name it. They have
like
a very bad habit of dying
of
young.
Sure. Like JFK, there are a lot of strange deaths around him. Yeah. Okay.
I have a list of around 300 when it comes to JFK, and but this is in when it comes to Olof Palme. There's a long, long list. In my book, Coup d'etat in slow motion, that I have a whole chapter just about strange deaths, and it's just part of the whole thing. You know, when they cover it up, they need to silence people.
Okay.
So that was Jimmy. Very tragic, very, very talented musician. So very, very tragic. John Lennon. John Lennon was a man that stood for peace, unity, freedom for everyone. All these beautiful ethic morals that most of us cherish. And he had been gone for quite a while. The FBI and other forces had tried to knock him out, you know, in many, many different ways. And they didn't manage. Then he became a father and he decided to take care of his son. So he was sort of living quite a discreet life for quite a few years together with Yoko Ono. Mm-hmm. Then he came to a point just before 1980, where he decided to make a comeback. And he had planned a big, big peace tour in the States that would then be followed with a peace tour in Europe and maybe globally. And once again, here was somebody just like Lady Diana. When he spoke, people listened. You know, he was like an icon just like Diana. And so they had just recorded his comeback album, and they were doing some remastering or whatever. They came from the studio, and when they arrived at outside the Dakota Building, near Hyde Park, Central Park in New York, the official story said that the man that shot Kennedy officially, Mark Chapman, was standing to the right of the limo. He had been waiting outside the building the whole day, waiting for John to come back home. And when the limo stopped, Yoko left at first, and then John followed like 5-6 meters behind her, walking in towards the entrance and into the building. Then you look at the crime scene. The official story is that several shots were fired. John went down, started crawling into the building. Yoko came out screaming. The guy that Chapman, who said to have shot him, was just standing there doing absolute nothing. John was then taken to hospital where he was declared dead, and the police came and grabbed Mark Chapman, and that's the story that he later said that he was guilty of the crime, and he's been put away. He's still in there. Okay, so you come to the scene. I always come with as open mind as possible. I use what I call Farmer Brown logic, 1 + 1 = 2. Doesn't matter who tries to tell you it's 74. If somebody is trying to force that truth, so-called truth, down your throat, you will know that it's not true. 1 + 0 does not equal 74, even if you can show it in a 3D animation or in a fancy laboratory. It is not. And the reason why they're trying to push it down your throat is because they're trying to hide the real truth. So that is one way of backtracking it to the real motive. Okay, so I come to the crime scene and you look at what happened there. You look at the angles, the trajectory and so on, and you see that all shots that hit John Lennon was fired straight from the left in a very close vicinity in the body. You know, even some of the bullets hit so close that it was hard to tell if it was one bullet or more that had hit at the same place. So was Mark Chapman anywhere near that location? No. So, Farmer Brown logic, who was standing to the left? I think that's a fair question to ask. Mm-hmm. And at this evening, there was a doorman His name was José Perdomo, and he had a background in the CIA. He's the guy who is said to have run over to Chapman screaming, "Do you know what you did? You just shot Lennon. You just shot Lennon," and taken the gun away from him. When he said that, Chapman went into like a zombie state and just stood waiting, sat down and just waited for him to be picked up. But this, when you start tracking down this doorman that disappeared in history right afterwards, he was mentioned by name just once, and it was just because I knew his name that I reacted, otherwise I would never noticed. And then after that, he for years, he was just mentioned as the doorman, and nothing else. Now, José Perdomo, for about 10 years, he was one of the highest-ranking officers in, here it comes, Operation 40.
Wow.
Now, how big are the chances? You tell me, how big are the chances that one of the top assassins in the world were there as a doorman that evening, standing exactly in the location where the shots were fired from?
Sure. No,
okay,
that's,
that was
yeah.
John Lennon.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have
okay.
Bob Marley.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Marley, I would suggest that if people think that he was just a dope-smoking, Rastafari with no brains or something, I think they make a major mistake because Bob Marley, he grew up on Jamaica. He had his dad was one of the ranchers on Jamaica, a very rich person, and his mother was a poor black woman on Jamaica. And this his father, I don't know if he raped his mother or if they had an affair, whatever. He never met his father, as far as I know. But he grew up as a half-breed mulatto.
Mm-hmm.
And this made his life very, very hard because the black population didn't want to know him. The white population didn't want to know of him. But that was almost like a boot camp for him to grow up in, really strengthening his character and so on. So when he grew up, he was a very, I wouldn't say angry, but a person with very, very strong views. And the thing that he found was that through music, he could express these and they would be received and listened to. And he could suddenly connect with both the black and the white population and so on. So he started this band called the Wailers and soon became a very well-known character on Jamaica and so on. Then in the mid-70s, during the whole 70s, the CIA, the elite, and people like Henry Kissinger was trying to target country by country by country. They took out many countries with military coups supported totally by the CIA, where Henry Kissinger was one of the key players, and where Operation 40 was very central in this as well. Like when they took out Salvador Allende in Chile on 9/11, 1973, Operation 40 was so, yeah, they love these dates.
Like 3/11.
On 9/11, 1970.
Okay. Anyway, so continue.
And also you have 9/11 also. Do you know what happened 9/11, 1991, exactly 10 days before 9/11, the World Trade Center? Exactly 10 days on the date. Do you know what happened on that day?
What was that?
That was when George Herbert Walker Bush went out openly talking about the New World Order for the first time. His New World Order speech that you can find on YouTube was on 9/11, 1991.
And Benghazi after 9/11
in the
also.
Date.
Well, this
sorry?
Is what you're talking about, numerology. Anyways, can you please get back to Bob Marley then?
Anyway, so they had taken out countries like Argentina, Chile, Bolivia, they were messing up the whole Central America, and then came Jamaica. And in 1975, they targeted Jamaica, and they sent in lots and lots of weapons, provocateurs. And one of the people they sent in as well was a man by the name of Luis Posada Carrillas. He was a key member in Operation 40, a very, very violent a man who was involved in hundreds and hundreds of blowing things up. I mean, it's unreal. It's unreal what these people have been involved in. I just want to say on my website, lightonconspiracies.com, You can find my book, Coup d'etat in Slow Motion. And in one chapter, I'm just describing one of the people from Operation 40, one of the friends of Luis Posada Carriles and the other people. His name was Orlando Bosch. He mm-hmm. was called Dr. Death. And in one chapter, just to show what type of people we're talking about, I'm putting a list of the things that he was sentenced for, not the things he committed, but the things that he was actually sentenced for. And it's page up, page down, page up, page down, page up, page down of different terror acts so closely. I mean, within a week, there's one there, there's one in Peru, there's one in Puerto Rico, there's one in Cuba, there's one in the state that, doom, doom, doom. I mean, they blew up Cuban airliners. They tried to shoot at the UN building with bazookas. I mean, totally crazy things. And then both he and Luis Posada Carriles and other people, once they ended up in jail, they were pardoned by, guess who? George Herbert Walker Bush.
Mm.
Unreal.
I'm shocked.
The same people again and again. And anyway, so Jamaica, 75. Henry Kissinger comes down and threatens the people in power. He also sends in all of these groups that starts creating almost like a civil war there. They pump in weapons. They do a lot of arsons. You know, they burn down buildings. They start shooting people right, left, and center, and so on. So it comes to a point where they call for martial law. The whole island is in a total chaos. And the one that is called for is no one less than Bob Marley, because they see him, the people on the island see him as one that could maybe put sort of oil on the waves, a possible way of getting back into a peaceful negotiation. So he agrees on making a concert, and that concert is aimed to unite the island again. So many people say, but my God, if you do this concert, they're going to shoot you as well, you know. You do. But he was determined, I'm going to do it. Okay. So just a few days before the concert is going to take place, a team of assassins enter the house where he and his wife and his manager are. They are in the kitchen just having a coffee, and suddenly somebody throws up the door and starts firing just crazily into the kitchen. His manager is shot four times in the stomach, once in the spine. His wife Ruth was hit in the back of the head, goes down, and Bob, there was a bullet that just touched his chest and then lodged in one of his upper arms, and so it was a miracle, really a miracle, that nobody was killed.
Really?
But did that stop Bob Marley? No. He, even though people came to him all the time saying, my God, they're going to kill you, they're going to kill you, please don't go, please don't go, he still came. He came a bit late, some 5 hours late to the concert. He came, he started playing, and in the end he managed to get the two leaders of the government and the party in power and the opponents, both these two main leaders, up on stage shaking hands, you know.
Wow.
Incredible. So after that, I think they really started to see that this is a guy we cannot stop easily, you know. So about a week after this concert, Bob Marley was approached by a filmer, a documentary maker. His name was Carl Colby, and what he wanted was to make a documentary about Bob Marley, how he grew up, all of these things. And Bob said, yeah, sounds good. Then... As a thank you, a gesture, Carl Colby gave Bob Marley a pair of cowboy boots, because Bob was very much into fitness, football, these type. He was very fit and loved his jeans and loved cowboy boots, so this was the perfect present. And there was a photographer, I think his name was Lee Lee, I think, a famous Hollywood photographer that was present mm-hmm. when he was given this gift. And he says that when Bob pulled on one of these boots, he just cried out and in pain. They pulled off the boot, and inside the boot they found a piece of copper wire that had punctured his big toe.
Jesus.
Okay, so anyway, I just want to say that this is the exact same toe that Bob Marley later got cancer in. That was
so
where the
like
whole cancer started.
Okay, we've got about 15 minutes. I wanted to kind of quickly go over Whitney Houston and maybe Michael Jackson, if we can go over quickly and then
Can I just go back to Bob Marley first? Because Carl Colby is actually the son of Bill Colby, the director of the CIA. You know, so how big are the chances one again? And Carl Colby was also one of the main witnesses in the O.J. Simpson trial because he was one of the neighbors of O.J. Simpson's wife. You know, once again, very central cases in world history, and the same people pop up again. I'm not accusing Carl Colby of having done this deliberately, but I'm saying that I'm sure that the CIA was involved in the delivery of these boots. Maybe he didn't know what he was delivering. I don't know. But that was what later slowly, slowly killed Bob Marley.
Wow.
Okay, Whitney. Whitney Houston was not killed for political reasons at all, I think. She was just an incredible singer. As far as I know, she sold like 170 million records. I mean, that is unreal. That is unheard of. But she came, you know, this power group, they have infiltrated all main areas in modern life where they can really control the population and manipulate the population. And this is very obvious in the film industry and the music industry. And so the music industry that used to be about talent and who is the best singer and so on has turned totally around to being a matter of money and power and manipulation, mass manipulation. Very, very sad development. And quite a few major stars have been threatened big time, say, when they have been confronted with the words that you are worth more dead than alive. This is what was told to Chaka Khan, one of Whitney Houston's friends, and Whitney was also told it, and her career was going straight down. She used to have an incredible voice, and then due to bad living, drugs, you name it, it started fading for her. And when she died, she was 48. There was really no way back. The last concert she made, the voice was just not there anymore. And I would suggest that she was taken out in a very awful way, like in a ritual murder, because she was worth so much more dead than alive. If you see how the whole thing was set up, also I need to go into a little of these ritualistic things because this is how they... The official story is that Clive Davies, her manager, the guy that discovered her and who's very central in Sony and the music industry, they prepared like months before. They were sort of coming out with the new Whitney Houston, a singer, Jennifer, what's her name, Jennifer Hodges
Hudson.
Or something like that. I'm sorry.
Yes.
Hudson, that's the one. That the new Whitney Houston. Also, they prepared to make a remake of The Bodyguard. They just had the film Sparkle was just going to, they was in the final stages of producing the whole thing. And then... she died on the 12th of February, which is just 2 days before Valentine's. And the thing that she was famous for were love songs. Valentine's, that's the day when all these love songs are played. And one of the top ones that has been played, the top of the top of the top, is I Will Always Love You.
Oh, I love that song, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful, incredible song.
Mm-hmm.
But you will see that there's a lot of preparation done so that as soon as she died, boom, everything is prepared for a massive, massive income and sale of albums. You know, she wasn't even dead hardly before Sony and iTunes raised and doubled the price of all her albums and everything. Like, how did that happen? So quick, boom, and everything was just set into motion.
Sure.
But let's go back to the day she died, because this was the day where there was a pre-Grammy gala in the Beverly Hilton Hotel in Los Angeles, And I would also want to point out many of these assassinations are done in Los Angeles, I think, because the police there is, some of the parts are very corrupt, and they use the same people to cover the, these things all up. So anyway, the official story is that the pre-Grammy gala was going to take place at the basement of this hotel. There was about 800 people. All the people, the key people in the music industry of today, was going to gather down there. And Whitney had rented a whole suite in this hotel. She had been, she had just met a new friend and spent the last few days with this woman. And that is during these days when they were out doing things. That is where all these photos are taken, where she looks totally drugged out and totally, I don't know if she was or not, but I just know that with photography you can do a lot if you want to make somebody look pretty or if you want to make somebody look absolutely awful. It's very easy to take photos that is not for your own best and so on. Anyway, so the official story is that about 2:30 in the afternoon, she comes to the suite and she enters the room. She's supposed to take a bath, and then 1 hour later, she's found dead in the bathtub. Okay. Now, one of the things that is odd is that she was found with her head down under the water and her feet up against the wall. And her body was already cold. Now, how is that possible? It is not, and especially not if you take a hot bath. You know, how could the body be cold already? She must have died earlier. This is pure Farmer Brown logic. Anyway, so you look into what happened. As soon as she was, they called for medics and everything, and she was pronounced dead. So what did they do? Did they take the body to the morgue? Did they take it to the hospital? Did they do anything like that? No. The body was left there for almost 12 hours in the suite while the whole party was going on downstairs, just below them.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very, very odd. And then the day before she died, the exact same scenario happened, but to Whitney Houston's daughter, Bobby Christina, where she was found in the bathtub almost unconscious. And it was only because her friends came knocking on the door and they managed to get the security of the hotel to open up that they found her and got her going again, because it seemed like she had been drugged with something, some weird thing. So the question is, were maybe there was champagne in the suite that was laced somehow, if that was the way that it's very odd that both Bobby Christina and then Whitney 24 hours later was going through the exact same experience, even though Whitney ended up dead. Then you have there was a guest that lived on the floor below Whitney's suite, and he said that about 2:30 in the morning, he heard there was a lot of commotion going on upstairs, and there was a major leakage in the bathroom. So he called the hotel management and said, please, something is going on. You know, you need to stop this leakage. So he went together with a member of the staff. They went upstairs, and this man opened the door, and he said to the guest that, do you know what? This is actually Whitney Houston's suite. So they went in there. The man did not see the bathroom or anything like that, but what he did notice was there was a flat screen that had been smashed.
Hmm.
So if you look at the normal logic when a body dies and how long it takes for it to get cold and stiff and so on, that would be an approximate time that would make sense, that maybe that was when it happened, and then she was just put in the bathtub or found very conveniently later in the afternoon.
Okay.
Then also,
we got about 5 minutes left, so I just want to, if you want to talk any more about the Michael Jackson, I just want to, you know, and what you want to say in concluding remarks. So,
okay, I'm sorry if I drag it out, but Michael Jackson is a case that I have not looked into very much. I know that he was very during his last few years, he was suddenly becoming a very, very strong individual, confronting the leadership of Sony, indirectly the elite as well, trying to expose what was going on in the music industry, and then this happened. I say, I have not looked enough into this to talk about it, but I know that one of the things with the drugs that was found next to Whitney Houston, they said that she had taken these drugs and wine and so on. They were bought at the same chemistry, the same pharmacy as Michael Jackson's. This exact same address, the exact same pharmacist that was found next to Michael Jackson was found next to Whitney Houston.
Wow.
But also with Whitney, if you go to Google Mac and you look at the Beverly Hilton Hotel, look from above, and you will see that on the roof of this hotel, like I said, they like these symbols, they like these Freemasonry things and locations where they commit these assassinations. If you look at the Beverly Hilton Hotel from the top, you will see that there are big sun symbols on the roof, on the ceiling, that will not be visible from down on the street level. And then the building where she was found in, that is almost in the shape of an arrow. So if you follow the arrow where it's pointing just a few hundred meters straight to the two towers called the Century Plaza Hotel. Mm-hmm. Now, the two towers are triangular, and in the garden between these two towers, if you look down there, even though they try to hide it on Google Map now, but you will see that the garden is an absolute perfect pyramid with the lawn made and where the path, the pavements and the paths. It's a perfect pyramid with the all-seeing eye. And also right on the other side of the hotel, out in the street, you have a fountain that is the all-seeing eye, perfectly done with this squirting water, this water fountain. And that is on the Avenue for the Stars, or it's named the Avenue of the Stars. That one is... I don't know if it's connected. I'm just pointing these things out.
Sure.
But what I can say is that that there were some very, very odd things going around Whitney Houston's death. And also... Mm. Her husband's sister, she's been fighting ever since, trying to prove that it was actually an assassination that took place, that a murder, and has been very fearful for Bobby Christina's life as well, that maybe she would stand in line and so on.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So
I wanted to kind of make a couple points. So they assassinate people not always – they assassinate for a number of different reasons. One is, for example, in her case, maybe to just simply to make more money because, like I said, she was a fading star whose best days were behind her. They assassinate people because they – obviously, in the case of Kennedy, it was obvious, you know, if they're opposing their agenda or if they see it as a way to make more money or if they see someone who is – a peacemaker, I mean, like a Martin Luther King or Malcolm X towards the end of his life was, you know, very much into you know, unifying people. So there can be a variety of different reasons that they would take someone out, maybe as a symbol to other people, where they want, you know, people in the network to realize that we can get anybody. So, in other words, there's a number of different reasons that people might be taken out. Maybe they're... you know, like I said, like with Marley and with other people. So, essentially, if they're either impeding them or they see some kind of gain to taking them out, these are the people that they that Operation 40 tends to take out. What other names does Operation 40 go? Hello. Okay, it looks like we've lost the caller here. Huh? It's only a couple minutes left here. Anyways. Okay, it looks like we've lost the caller. Probably something happened on his side. Anyways, with that, I'm going to have to terminate the call, and I'm going to have to terminate the show. Okay, so with that, I'm going to have to end the show, and this is Roger North signing off for True North. I hope you enjoyed the show. Thank you very much. Goodbye.